Hello, ladies and gents, and welcome back to the Coleman Had a Dream podcast. I am joined as always by Ruth. How are you doing, Ruth?
Okay, I mean, it's early, very early on a Monday morning here, so I suspect that shows, but I'm doing fine. What about you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. It's half, well, it's the, yeah, May break here, so I'm also struggling today, but because I'm hungover because I went out drinking on a Sunday, not because I've had to do anything constructive today. All I've done is play golf, but you're tired for different reasons as well, Ruth.
Yeah, very fortunate. Went to see the eclipse over on the East Coast a couple of weeks ago. So we had a mad dash, last minute decision. My son and I went across and flew to one place, flew out of another place, which must be about 1500 miles away, in and out into Boston, out of Detroit, chasing our tails, getting to the perfect position for the eclipse, but saw it. And it was, I can't describe it, Dave. You know the places I've traveled to. I've been very fortunate. I've seen some amazing things around the world. It was singularly the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And if people get a chance to ever see a total eclipse, take it. Just take the chance. So yeah, it was stunning. But I've been chasing my tail to get that in place and then chasing my tail at work since. So I'm a little, you know, discombobulated and very Monday morning-ish in particular
I
today.
can imagine. I mean, I assume you say it's the single greatest thing you've ever seen, with the exception of Hal Robson-Kanu's goal against Belgium.
Yeah, but
one
I wasn't
assumes.
there in person. I wasn't there in person for that. So, you know,
Yeah,
there is a slight, difference.
I'll give you the pass on that one. I'll give you the pass. Yeah, and I was just saying to you, Ruth, before we started recording, you saw the solar eclipse for 3.5 minutes. And as you say, Boston and Detroit are not close together. So the fact that you've done all that, whereas I fly to, you know, Istanbul for a football match, in the grand scheme of things, I would actually say that my obsession with traveling around is actually, you know, possibly more sensible than yours on that basis.
I think you might win that one.
I'll take that. I'll definitely tell Joy.
You can try that argument with Joy, at least.
It's worth a go, isn't it? It's worth a go. Yeah, I'm going to have to go to Podgorica and Reykjavik, because if you remember, Ruth went all that way for 3.5 minutes. Okay, what a waffling start this is, even by our standards. We are back, ladies and gents, to talk about the women's game. They won 4-0 and 6-0 against Croatia and Kosovo, respectively. A lot of stuff happened on the camp, so we're going to talk through a lot of that. There were some figures released recently about the revenue for the FAW, that they are now generating $32 million in revenue, so we're going to discuss that a little bit. We're going to discuss the fact that Wrexham have got promoted, and speaking of Wrexham, we're going to talk about the fan who's got a banning order, which is ridiculous. We're going to talk about the FA Cup replay being scrapped, and we are going to talk about Leighton James a little bit to conclude. Ruth, how much of the two women's games did you get to see?
I didn't actually get to see much live, unfortunately, but obviously got to see some decent highlights afterwards. Yeah.
I could only watch the Croatia game live. The timing of the Kosovo game, which I'll come to later, was ridiculous. Meant that I was in work, so I couldn't watch the Kosovo game. But I've managed to catch up with the goals and other highlights. I thought the Croatia game was excellent. I thought we played really, really well, very much on the front foot, like completely dominated the game, 75% possession. It was a great start to the Rhian Wilkinson reign.
Yeah, I thought the second half in particular, we were very good, used the available space much better in the second half. And I think there was some inference to that in various interviews that everybody had a bit of a kick at half time to make use of the space that was available and not be frightened of running into things and stretching them. And then all the goals are, you know, I thought the feeds from Gemma Evans, that she was involved in a couple of the goals with those lovely long passes from out on the left, sort of across the box and across the keeper. That it was just a nice game of football to watch, frankly.
Yeah,
very entertaining.
I agree. I think we're fully in control, and I think it was great to see so many of our attacking players on the pitch at the start of the game. Powell obviously getting a start was interesting as well, but good to see James, Ingle, Rowe, Fishlock, Hughes all starting. Woodham, kind of coming on and attacking from left back. I thought it was really exciting. But again, the highlight for me, we will come to the goals in a sec, but one of the biggest highlights for me was the amount of changes. You know, Morgan got on, Griffiths, McAteer, Joel and Holland all got on and contributed in some way. And that's something I don't think we would have seen so readily in the Gemma Granger era.
No, I mean, that was something we were talking about a lot previously, weren't we, back in the autumn before the changes. So I think all in all, you couldn't ask for much by the start, really, could you? Just, you know, put two game window, everybody came through it healthy. As you said, some good turnover, some saving of legs, somewhat experimental at times with different people in different positions. So, I mean, it served its purpose as a first game for a new manager, and obviously was a great way to start the Nations League.
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at the goals, I thought it was great to get the early goal with Fishlock. I did actually think we would kind of kick on after that.
Yeah.
But we didn't do so much in the first half. But again, just a great bit of football, lovely little ball in from Rowe, classic Fishlock breaking forward. And I think when she was through with the keeper, there was only going to be one outcome. And I think that as the game was... Go on.
Sorry, Dave, that would be my one criticism, is that we didn't seem to really kick on after that goal.
Agreed.
It took the second half for us to really get going. But that's, I mean, it feels like you know, picking up a new shoe at that point.
And it's mad, really, that we scored then the rest of the goals in a 7-minute spell, ultimately. Mm. The Fishlock second one, I loved her bravery there. She was, when the ball comes back to her off the bar, she looks like she's desperate to get kicked in the face, but managed to avoid it and still scores. I thought Rowe's goal was lovely. I thought she was the best player on the night for me. Mm-hmm. And a lovely little kind of sliding finish from Angharad James at the end.
Yeah.
I also thought, I agree entirely what you said. I had a few messages back and forth with Gwenan Harris after the match, and mm-hmm. she said the same sort of thing, that in terms of the balance between the first half and the second half, yeah. in that we really did seem to kick on. I still felt we could have done more, in fact, second mm-hmm. half. I think, you know, if I know we're not at the same level as in England or France or whatever, but I think in England or France, go and beat that team, you know, 8-0 or something. Like, they really punished them for barely having the ball and whatever. And I felt like we didn't do that. And it's not a criticism. I just think it shows a lot of what potential we have in the team. That whilst I'm not saying we could have beaten them by 8, although we probably could have, that gear change, that mindset mm-hmm. change is what we needed. And I think we then got that when we played the Kosovans in the next game, because I just felt like we obliterated them, basically.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think you've got to... I was actually listening to a podcast coming in this morning. It's a cycling podcast, it's not a football podcast, but one of the points that was being made was a very dominant women's team last year who haven't been as dominant this year. And it was making the point that as soon as people can see a sort of crack, a gap, and realise that they're vulnerable, then it's been forced wide open this year. And I think there's a little bit of that mentality in these games as well, that, you know, you just need to get that first goal. You need to kind of establish yourself. Then you can push at things. And I don't think we saw that much more in the Kosovo game.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. And I think as that game wore on, obviously, we kind of walked all over them, really, like a completely dominant victory. And when you think about, again, how we've got into the game, and then we've scored, what, 2 in the first half, and then again we've just kind of gone at it and just killed them second half. I thought that was a much better kind of all-round performance once we got going. Obviously, Jess got a 150th cap, which is mad. That was the other thing, is that she's now moved ahead of Gareth Bale in the goal-scoring charts, and I think she's 2 behind Helen Ward as Wales's greatest all-time top goal scorer. Sorry, so I think that would be a great record for her. I think I love Helen Ward. We've had her on the pod. She's a lovely person, and I don't doubt her qualities as a footballer, but I think it would be fantastic for Jess. And women's football and Welsh football, really, for her to be our all-time top goal scorer. If you think about what she's done for Welsh football,
and
how many times she's played, I think it'd be a great fitting end to, you know, she's talking about this being her last campaign. So I think it'd be a fitting end to her Wales career to go out as Wales's top goal scorer as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'd all like to see that.
To look at that game in itself, I mean, the first thing I wanted to say was the kickoff time. Absolutely farcical. It was 1 o'clock, I think, here. That quite simply would not have happened in men's football, that a qualifying match would have started at 1 o'clock. And there were loads as well, by the way. There were loads of games that started at 1 o'clock. And every time we think you're making progress with women's football and everything that's going on with that, you see something like that. And it's not a huge issue in the grand scheme of things. You know, people aren't queuing around the block to go and watch Wales Kosovo, but it's the principle of it that it's hidden away almost at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. So I did think that was a real shame.
I mean, it's part of that the time difference to Kosovo? I mean, what would that have been, a kickoff time in Kosovo?
I'm not sure. They're a bit further ahead. But I mean, again, there were other games that were kicking off at that time as well, that were in, the same kind of the time frame, if you like. So it's not purely
Right. It's not
Kosovans.
proper, it's not just the geography of it.
No, I am gonna Google that now. But
Okay.
yeah,
Well,
I
that's interesting if you've got, because how are you know, if it's kicking, let's say, I don't know, a game in Berlin is kicking the cut off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You're not drawing people to that, are
Exactly.
you? Yeah.
For what it's worth, Kosovo is at the same time, whatever it's called, window, as me in the Netherlands. So
Oh,
it's
okay.
5 past 5 here now. So it's 5 past 5 in Kosovo as well.
Right.
So yeah, I think that was a disappointment. But again, I part of me understands the logic in that it's Kosovo, Wales. There was not many Kosovans there, let alone anyone else. So I'm not hugely surprised because it's not a big draw. But again, you're never going to get a big draw to these sort of games if. If you don't put them on at a time that people can go and watch the game. But anyway, enough about that.
And good on the Welsh folks that were there. They made a lot
Yeah,
of noise, fair play.
there was a decent number of people there actually. Yeah, it was impressive. I thought again, just in terms of how we played, I was much more impressed with the way we moved the ball here, and I was much more impressed with the way we passed the ball, especially because I think the difference for me in the first game and the second was the second game we really passed the ball with intent. We took on kind of more dangerous, tricky passes, always looked to try and play forward. And I was really impressed by that. And some of the build-up play was excellent. And, again, we it's mad, really. We had, what was it, 17? Yeah, 17 shots, 7 shots on target. Like we absolutely battered them, even though they had more of the ball than Croatia did. In the other game, I was just really impressed with the interplay. Like I said, that was the standout thing for me, apart from the scoreline.
Yeah, no, it looked, and I think when there'd been the number of changes within the starting lineup as well, you think, look how many changes there are between the two games, the substitutions, and then the two games. There's a lot of different players that saw time between the two games. And I think so to have that cohesion across that wide variety of players, I think is very encouraging.
Yeah, and again, things we didn't see under Gemma Granger. We had 5 substitutes made in this game, which I thought was really important. Again, getting people on the pitch, giving people game time. Elise Hughes coming off the bench and scoring. I was really impressed with Kerry Holland. I got to say, I think like the variety of positions she can play, and I think is really impressive. And I think that she underlined that well in the way she was involved in the game. And again, great passing and movement. And I thought she was excellent. And was, yeah, probably should have got a goal, really. She got an assist, but should have got a goal. But yeah, overall, an excellent performance from her, I thought.
Yeah, and I thought you mentioned Elise Hughes. I thought she was very impressive when she came on. The highlights that I managed to catch were actually presumably with Kosovan commentary, and they were
Yes.
very impressed with Elise Hughes.
Oh, well,
I managed to get
good
that much
for
from their commentary.
them. Well, thank you very much, Kosovan TV. There was obviously one other big change that happened in that window, which was that Sophie Ingle stepped down as captain. I was really surprised, Ruth, not necessarily her stepping down per se, but the timing of it. I was really surprised that it didn't happen before the first game. It was weird to me that it happened between the two games. And it made me wonder if maybe, obviously, she's made that decision, but I wonder if it's also a decision she's made with the idea that the manager probably wanted to change it anyway, as she's coming new. But I don't know if I'm, again, looking for a story where there may not be one.
I think you might be, but you can't help it because the it seems an odd one, doesn't it,
Yeah.
overall. I mean, she's not, there's no question about her being involved in the team. It's not, you know, it's if we were having this discussion about Aaron Ramsey being captain amongst the men's team, you could make a case that he's not actually necessarily going to be starting games, whereas there isn't that question here.
Yeah.
It might be that she's just got to a point where she's not really enjoying it. You know, she strikes me as quite a quiet leader by example kind of person. Maybe Rhian Wilkinson wants someone that's a bit more kind of in your face a little bit more.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. Maybe she just needs more sort of rah-rah, or was looking for more sort of rah-rah than Sophie Ingle gives. I don't know. I'm hoping it's just been Sophie's choice, because I think she's done a great job. And I hope it's just that she fancies being one of the girls a bit more, and perhaps mentoring someone up and through, you know, knowing that the likes of Fishlock are not going to be around for much longer. Maybe it's time to mentor some of the younger ones into a role a bit more. So I don't know. I think it will be interesting to see what happens.
That's the thing forward. For me, because I'm not exactly sure who the alternatives are. I mean, there are some of them, obviously.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at it, because it's an age thing almost of passing on to the next generation, the people I'd say you'd be kind of looking at would be Ankara James. She's 29. Mm-hmm. She's going to be 30 this year. Hayley Ladd's already 30. Gemma Evans is probably a decent shout. She's going to be 27. She's 27 now, so she's going to be 28 in August. So it's not as if, like, you know, when Ingle took over the captaincy, I think she was 23. It's not someone in that sort of mold that I think is readily obvious, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like I said, it just seems odd. I mean, it made sense for Fishlock to do it in Kosovo as part of the 150th celebration, but I'd be surprised if that's what we see going forward.
Yeah, agreed.
So I don't know. I think Evans would be my choice.
I think Evans is a good shout. I think playing for Man United now, that's a good move. That's a good position that she's in. Sorry, I'm just not sure. I think I would go for James. I always like it when a midfielder is a captain, because they're kind of in the middle of the game. But again, I don't know how long she intends to play and whatever else. It's not like she's, you know, at the edge of her career right now. But it's, you know, at 30 years old, he says, preparing for his 40th birthday, that I don't know how much longer she would be the captain for. But I guess it gives Rhian Wilkinson a bit of time now to make that decision. With, you know, in collaboration with the rest of the squad ahead of the next round of games.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's just, like I said, it's interesting. It'd be interesting to see what falls out.
Let's move on. Oh, sorry, there's one more thing I wanted to say, that which is, after we played Croatia, they beat Ukraine. Ukraine had also previously beaten Kosovo in the other match. So at the minute, we're top of the group with 6 points. Croatia and Ukraine have 3 points, whereas Kosovo have none. So given the way that things will work out in this group and the situation with the seeding and whatever else with the playoffs, I think we're already in a very, very strong position. And you know, I think 6 more points in the next window and we're all but guaranteed a top seeding spot there. So I think that start was important, and hopefully it will put us on a strong footing.
Yeah, agreed. And I think the way the results went might ultimately help as well.
Oh, massively, yeah. I think Croatia and Ukraine taking points off each other, I think it also says a lot that Croatia beat Ukraine. Ukraine are only one or two places below us in the rankings. So the fact that Croatia beat them after we beat Croatia so comfortably, I think, is hugely encouraging. I think there's a lot to be positive about that. To move on to our second point, Ruth, there were figures released recently that the FAW have generated over $32 million in revenue. First of all, I was very impressed with that figure as a start point. I don't know about you, and a lot of that, I think, is from what they've said, has come from the Wales getting to the World Cup and everything that's gone with that, not just the money that we've got from FIFA, but shirt sales and blah, blah, blah. The thing that kind of surprised me about this is that there were a huge amount of "where's the money gone" type comments all over social media. People even asking for Mooney to go. I was really surprised by that in the first instance. And I wondered, you know, what you thought, because from the outside, you know, football for me is about the game that happens on the pitch. So, you know, I'm not that interested in the finance side of it, but I was, you know, that seems like a good amount of money for a country of our size to make. So, you know, I wonder what you thought about the questions that then followed that.
I mean, revenue is a bit of a strange one to highlight as a figure, because if you were left with 32 million sitting in the bank, then we'd be asking the FAW what they're doing with their money. But ultimately, after you do the book, books and they've done their investing, they're left with 715,000 operating losses in the same fiscal year. So then they have to look at their investments, pull from them investments, and ultimately they made a post-tax profit of 173,000 for that fiscal year. So that post-tax profit is about 0.5% of your revenue. Now that, to my mind, seems to be that you're operating the way a kind of not-for-profit should be. Your money's coming in and you're spending it. You're making sure that your books balance at the end of the year, but you're not hanging on to your money either. You're making it work. So on that basis, it seems like, I think the 32 is a bit spurious because that's going to be high because of the World Cup year. I think more of a concern is can you sustain that kind of investment going forward? Williams is making it sound like they can, but that's a very narrow margin on those post-tax profits. The Cymru Football Foundation, the numbers I could find for them didn't quite match the fiscal year. They went from October to September, but basically the same. And it said that they've invested 8.4 million in that same kind of window, which is 26% of the revenue. Now, to my mind, that when you consider that the revenue is also paying for all the staff, it's paying for, flights to games, it's paying for the hotels at games, it's paying for all your insurance, it's paying for everything. That actually seems quite a reasonable proportion of your revenue, 26%, that's going into the foundation. And the foundation is very much aimed at the grassroots. So without kind of really dissecting the books, and I don't have the expertise to do that, obviously, these numbers kind of make sense to me, and they kind of look like about the right amount of money is going in the right direction.
I thought the same. You've done definitely, as would be no surprise to regular listeners, much more research on this than I have. But I think the thing that struck me most about the whole thing was we're at a time here where we've qualified for three of the last five tournaments. We've got to the, of the two that we've not got to, we've missed out on a penalty kick, and we've gone to the last game for the 2018 World Cup before the actual tournament itself. I think it's a huge step up. And I think we've also got to remember with all of this stuff, we've been in a time where Welsh football has financially been a bit all over the shop. In realistically, we're looking at 8 years, we've gone from being a mess to, through qualifying for tournaments, having all this money. It's going to take time for us to know how to utilize this and do this properly. Even just creating a plan about how we use and spend the money takes time. You don't just get 32 million and just go, right, lads, let's go and buy a load of 4G pitches. Like, it doesn't work like that. Everything is time. Everything is planning, and who deserves this more than that? Where's there a bigger problem here than that? And, as you say, the cost of taking everyone, just this sheer logistics and costs of traveling to and from games. And it's not just the players. We're talking about the staff and the physios and the stuff that has to be transported and taken with them. It's not like everyone's got, EasyJet and you've got a backpack and a bag of balls. Like, there's so much stuff that goes. So even just those basic operating costs. What I think is really fascinating about it all is we talk about the rising costs of the shirts and the trainers and everything else for things of fans to buy, which is rightly so, because it's, exorbitant money. Yet on the same side, you've got people saying, where's the money gone? Why wasn't grassroots football in Wales completely changed? And I do find it an interesting mix of two sides of that conversation to have, because there is some sides of football which is super expensive, the shirt, but then also I think the going to the matches is eminently affordable. Again, compared to some other people and some other teams and clubs and whatever else. So I'm happy to point fingers when people are doing things badly or wrong. But for me, I don't really see that there's much to be done wrong here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's wider questions about the Cymru leagues and, how they're administered and what support they're getting, and teams that can't get promoted because they've got and I don't know, a stand that's got a leak in one corner or whatever it might, you know, whatever it might be. I think there are genuine questions about that. I think there are a sort of more administrative than fiscal, actually. Like, what is the support structure to help these these improvements happen? What are the timelines that everybody has? I think all of that, I think there's genuine questions there, but I'm not so critical about these numbers per se.
No, and you know, we've talked about a million times the administrative relegations and people stopping it, but we don't need to do that again. But again, you know, it's a perfect example of that to solve that kind of problem, which I think is one of the biggest things that makes the league relevant and competitive, is a huge undertaking that you can't just solve by throwing money at it. Money is the big helper, but more, it needs to be more than just that. I think it's worth noting that one of my ideas was to have an app that the FAW ran, and they show live games through their app. I would like Noel Mooney to be sending me a cheque for a couple of quid. Thank you very much. Because I noticed that the Cymru North games, I think four or five games were being shown on the Red Wall Plus app on the weekend just gone. So I think I've noted that, Mr. Mooney, and I expect a cheque in the post. But yeah, I think, again, all of these things take time, don't they? And I agree, there are huge question marks about the Welsh, the club game. But again, you know, you talk about a leak in a roof, like you say, some clubs require, when Llantwit Major almost got promoted, I think it was 2 years ago now, they basically would have needed two stands to be built, amongst other things, to make it viable for them to get promoted. Well, the FAW can't justify spending what would, you know, be the huge millions of pounds probably on just helping out Llantwit Major, as worthwhile as it may have been. It's got to be more spread out than that. So I think, again, you know, we've just got to adapt to being a bigger country in that sense financially, and as a consequence, the drip down of the money will take time to ultimately take a benefit from that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want people to think that we think that this is all rosy.
No,
but I think there's enough in these figures that make me comfortable with the proportion of revenue that is ultimately going to the foundation. My questions would be, what can we do to just make it easier for clubs to access these things, not leave clubs in this limbo where they're promoted but not promoted, just help it run more smoothly rather than necessarily fiscally more smoothly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And I agree, you know, I'm the same as you. I don't for a minute suggest that everything is rosy or perfect, but I also think we've got to be wary of everything that's gone on with this, that this is also a very time-consuming process. We're still waiting for the FAW to bring out plans for how they're going to redevelop the Cymru League. And there was chat about that today and still nothing's come out. I think they're going to be doing some presentations. One was in Merthyr. I forget where the other one was. So, you know, all of these things are going to take time, even just to announce and then act on. So I also do think some patience is required. You know, as you said there, if we're having this conversation in 4 years, and then nothing's changed, and they're not addressing those administrative promotions, relegations, whatever, then I think it's right to start pointing fingers, asking questions. But I think for where we are and what we've got right now, I think we're pretty much in as good a spot as we could be. Ruth, it's almost the time where our free Zoom runs out, so we'll have a little half-time break here, and we'll be back very, very soon. Hello, ladies and gents. We are back from our Zoom-enforced break, ready for the second half. Before we start, I just want to say a couple of quick things. First of all, you can go and support us by going to bagsybags.com and using the code CHAD10 to get 10% off, and we get a little cut of that too, as well, to help things through and keep this podcast free. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/ColemanStream, where you can give us a few quid and, again, help this podcast stay free. A big thanks to Make P.S. Owen, who has supported us and bought us three coffees, which is very kind, and again, will help keep this podcast free. So if you do want to go to buymeacoffee.com/ColemanStream, please do so and help keep this podcast free. Ruth, one of the next thing that we wanted to talk about was something I know is very close to your heart, which is Wrexham have got promoted. Great scenes again in North Wales, and I appreciate that we fans of other clubs who will be moaning that we're not talking about their club, but get promoted or get relegated and we will talk about you. A fantastic end of the season. It's been highly competitive division, I think, mm-hmm. League Two, and I think League One is a great place for Wrexham to be. I know that you are very fond of Wrexham. So, what was your overall feelings as the news came through?
I know it sounds funny, but it was this sort of visceral pride as much as anything. They've spent the whole season with a target on their back in every single game. They've had some key injuries at various points in the season that have knocked them about. And I think to come through the league and get an automatic promotion place, I think it just, you know, it just gives you confidence in where they are and where they're going and how sort of together they are. I mean, I think it'll be a real step up going into League One. You know, you're going to be playing teams which currently are playing in the Championship. I mean, you know, you're going to hit the Rotherhams or the Sheffield Wednesdays or the Huddersfields, you know, depending on exactly who is relegated. That's a different criteria of teams than they've faced so far.
Yeah.
But I think I think they're eminently capable of holding their own in League One. I think next year might be that season they have to consolidate. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. Let's not worry about next year. But I think right now, just very proud of them keeping going in what I think has actually been quite a tough season, really.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the teams that are in that division above them, you've got teams who've been in the Premier League not a million miles away. Reading are there, Charlton are there, Wigan are there. You know, they won the FA Cup not that long ago. And the teams that are going up, obviously Bournemouth, Derby, but again, Bolton are in and around it now. So, you know, there's a lot of quality teams in there. Blackpool. So again, you look at that and the teams that will come down, again, teams that have been in the Premier League not that long ago, it is a big step. I think you can, the jump between National League and League Two is probably not that huge a gap. But I think to go up again now, that step up is going to be a big one. I think the big question I'm interested in your thoughts is, what does this look like now? Because I think for the first time, Parkinson might be in a situation where he's got some big decisions. I think before he could have some of the players that had taken him up one division and supplement that with, you know, the extras, if you like, that they've brought in. But now there's going to be people who are there at the start of the journey who maybe aren't quite good enough to make the step up. And there's some big decisions to be made there.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would see more turnover than we saw last summer. It is difficult because you want to be loyal. You want to, and you also want to give people a chance to raise their game. But you can't hang around and make kind of decisions with the heart, you've got to make decisions with the head. So I think there will be some culling, sadly, come summer. Yeah,
I think so. I think when you look through, you know, some of the statistics from the season, they've conceded, they've scored 87 goals. So, you know, goals have not been the problem, really. I would say that maybe defensively is maybe an area where they may look to improve. They've conceded 51 goals, which is pretty good compared to, you know, the teams around them as well. But I think if you're going to try and, well, first of all, stay in the league and then try and get a mid-table finish, you know, you've got to be perhaps doing a little bit better than that. There are teams, you know, down at 12th, AFC Wimbledon, who've conceded the same amount of goals as Wrexham, give or take. So that's not a superb number either. So I wonder if that's the area they may look to make things a bit better. And I also wonder, their away form, I don't know how you can target that with players, but maybe some more experienced players who are used to playing that division, because their away form has not been great at times this year.
Yeah, that would be the concern. I think there's some consolidating needed.
Yeah.
You know, you look at how far they've moved in the last 18 months or so. I think there needs to be a season of embedding some new players as well, inevitably getting some systems going, and then push forward from there.
I think it's important to also have a look at a bit of a wider picture, because I know everyone hates this probably, if you're not a Wrexham fan, but the impact that this has had, and the two Americans coming over, well, American and a Canadian, sorry, coming over and having on this is huge. And I think they've had a real positive impact on Wales, on Welsh language, mm-hmm. on the north of Wales as a whole, mm-hmm. but Wrexham in particular. And I think I think Wrexham doing well and going up the divisions is actually could be a big thing for Welsh football in general, not just because of those extra things, but also I think it pays in footballing terms and probably financial ones for Wales to have clubs further up the pyramid. And you know, if we could get to the point where Cardiff, Swansea and Wrexham are all in the Championship, I think it'd be amazing, especially with Wrexham, you know, having a new part of the ground being built and everything else. I think it'd be really important to have that. And again, would be a big boost for Welsh football in general.
Yeah, I think it's hard to underestimate the impact they're having, even over here. Like, I can now say I'm from North Wales and people know what I mean. Yeah. Over here, it's not a mystery. And I think that is almost entirely down to Ryan and Rob, really. Obviously, the World Cup helped, but I think there's a far wider audience has connected it with it through watching the documentary than actually directly connect with the football.
Yeah. There was one thing I did want to mention. We're a little bit out of date, but other things have kind of taken over. About two and a half weeks ago, there was a Wrexham fan who yelled, "You dirty English bastards," at Tranmere supporters. And for that, was slapped with a 3-year football ban for racist abuse. Now, I'm not condoning calling people dirty English bastards. I also know that I and probably everyone who listens to this podcast, dare I say it, even you, Ruth, have probably said something similar or worse during a football match. And it doesn't make it okay, but it's also, it's fine, because I would say that every single away fan who goes to Cardiff, Swansea, Wrexham, Newport in the English pyramid will have called them, though the home fans, sheep shaggers at some point, and possibly worse, you dirty Welsh bastards, probably in response. You know, I think this does set a real dangerous precedent for football in general. I got to be honest.
You see, I don't think I'm as vehement about it as you are. I think there were circumstances around what happened. It wasn't in the ground. It happened twice. The second, from what I understand from what was reported in the court, he shouted it once. He then came, as the line of Tranmere fans were being escorted by the police into the ground, this guy, and I think the fact that his name is public is something that shouldn't have happened. I don't think that's fair.
No.
But this guy shouted it once, but then came back with more people and shouted again. And I think from the police point of view, there is a ramping up in his actions at that point. Now, do I think you should be banned from football for shouting what you shouted? No, I don't. But I can understand how this may have acted as a trigger point for the police, where we've got to come down on this guy.
I get your logic. I just wonder that my biggest thing with all of this, and we say this stuff to kids in school all the time, is about consistency, right? If this is going to be the thing now, then okay, my thoughts on it aside, this is the thing now. So now there's going to be, you know, 90% of English football fans visiting Welsh football clubs who are going to get 3-year banning orders. That's got to be the next thing, right?
That's the concern, is if this is the model we want, and we don't want people shouting these things. So if this is the model we want, then you've got to consistently address it. I think obviously the problem for the police is they can't arrest 15,000 out of a 30,000 crowd. Do you know what I mean? It's not going to happen. But these, an individual behaving in an individual way, very directly to a group of opposing fans, they can see that as a threat. They can see that as aggression in a way that they don't see a big crowd within a contained football stadium. And I'm not saying it's right, Dave, but I think that's the difference here. I think that's why this one has ended up in court.
I just think that if you're going to...
And it's not it's not right, because the words are the words regardless of the setting. So I don't think this is an easy scenario at all. And I feel for the lad, because like you say, he will have been in crowds where that and worse has been shouted repeatedly. But also I think if we don't try and stop this sort of thing, if we don't try and stamp it out, it's not going to get better if we don't try. And I think the fact that English or Scouse is used in this, it's very easy for us to kind of put England in this kind of power broker situation, and everybody else is pushing against that. That still doesn't make it right. It still doesn't make it something that should be allowed. And I think if the person had said a different nationality, not English, something that a country that we think is more prone to racial slurs, then we might be more comfortable with the 3-year ban. And I don't think you can have degrees. I think it's either you're either giving people parameters based on, okay, if you name a country, it's a racial slur, and that's what it says in the Sentencing Act. Your nationality, your citizenship is a race in that sense for the Sentencing Act. And so I think you can't have criteria for that. You can't have levels of that. It's either you're stepping over the line or you aren't. And I think that's the problem, because the line is so blurry now. The line is so difficult to define. What happens inside stadiums with what you might think of as banter from one set of fans to another versus what's going out on outside. It's the environment kind of feels different to us as supporters, but you can't have that difference in society.
I think what's difficult with this, there's two things for me. One is, I really, this doesn't happen very often where we disagree like this. I love it. But I really disagree with the notion that if we replace English with a different nationality, more prone to racial slurs, that the difference there for me is that is a difference. Is because,
but it's not in a legal setting, Dave.
Well, no, but this is my point, though, right? Is that it may not be in a legal setting, but also the line, as you mentioned there, is super blurry. So, in a legal setting, I also think that works both ways. If the line is blurry, then you also can't be just entirely black and white about it. I also think that if you take there is a historical context to everything that happens in this sort of arena. And I think if you take the historical context of Wales and England as an example, then I think that changes the context of it. I think if someone used that phrase, but instead of Scouse said Indian, then I think there is a different social context to that. And I do think there is a difference. I really do think there's a difference. And legally, there may not be. But in terms of how we approach it, I think there is a difference there. Neither of them are right. But I think there's a difference. And I think the second thing to go with that is if people are coming out and saying, in an attempt to stop the way that people are interacting at football matches, these things are wrong. You will get arrested. You will get a 3-year ban in order, blah, de, blah, de, blah. If that is the parameters that of being created, fine. I can go with it. But I think what's hard is that I've heard 10 times worse things than that. Again, cards on the table. I've probably said worse things than that. Maybe not about race necessarily, but you know, let's say again, to use the example, dirty English bastard. I'm sure that has, crossed my lips at a football match before. So I do think that if that is the rule, then we've got to do something about it. The thing I have a real problem with about it is that it's as if arbitrarily someone has decided that this one person is the one person we're going to take action on. And that's the thing I don't like about it, because if you're going to go after doing something about this, then there has to be a universal approach. And the thing that boils me most is that if you go to a football match and you are a normal law-abiding citizen, as I would like to consider myself as I am, about 2% of people who go to football matches get arrested. And the majority of that 2% is for drug and alcohol offences, nothing to do with fighting or racism or whatever.
Yeah.
So the percentages are hugely the other way. I think if you were going to look at that as a positive, that 97.something% of people who go to football matches are good law-abiding citizens, then I do, again, I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying that I also wonder if we're trying to make something that's not, because how many times have you seen policemen at football matches who are just stood there watching the match and things are kicking off around and people are saying this, that and the other, and they turn a blind eye to it. It's the same with the steward and the security staff and whatever. And I think that is my problem with it, is that if we're saying the police have got to be seen to do something about this because they consider it a threat, I would say 3,000 people at the Cardiff City Stadium chanting "you sheep shagging bastards" is just the same in terms of a threat as a bloke who comes away and comes back with five of his mates. I just think that it sets a really dangerous precedent, and I really dislike the fact that it is localized. This is not going to happen up and down the country every week. And if we're going to go out and do something about the things that people say at football, which is wrong, which we absolutely should do, then that needs to be a concerted effort, not just some what feels to me a tokenistic attempt to shut someone up, is what it comes across as to me.
I'd agree with all of that, Dave. I think my quandary is that we have to move forward as a community. In the wider sense, we have to move forward. And so we have to make a point that racist slurs aren't acceptable. And I think if you start then categorizing that and saying, okay, so if I used the word, you know, if I use this nation, it's okay. And if I use that nation, it's not, that's subjective at that point. You can't have that sort of thing in the legal situation. So I think it's more about I think we need to be better as a, like internally, like as a group of football supporters, we need to be better at calling each other out when someone steps out of line.
I agree with that. Of
just doing more to improve this ourselves and kind of modeling what's acceptable. And while we're doing that, there's going to be this grey area. And I feel sorry for this lad because he's fallen into a grey area. And I think he's been picked on in that sense.
100%.
When he's not actually stepped that far out of line compared to what's going on around him. But he has crossed a line and there are consequences for that.
Yeah, like I say, I don't condone the thing he said, and I don't want to go in circles. You're right. Yeah. He shouldn't have said it. There is a consequence. I do not think in any way the consequence is a fair representation of the problem. If you want to, the biggest thing I agree with you there is that I think as football fans we need to do more, and I think that's the crux of it for me. I think that's how it gets better, because you can say what you want about the police and stewards. But I think that's the way you make a change, is by empowering people to do and say stuff at football matches, which controls. And that's really hard, and that's going to take a long, long time. But I do think that that is the approach. I think giving people consequences like this like scattergun approach, I think is never going to fix this problem. It arguably creates a bigger division between football fans and the police, which is already quite a big divide as it is. And I think then, as I say, the whole thing becomes completely counterproductive. But anyway... that's interesting debate on our side. We are almost finished with, I'm wary of the time. There was one more thing we wanted to mention, and I'm going to hand over to you to talk about Leighton James, who sadly passed away last week.
Yeah, just another of those players from my youth that are sadly passing away. It's happened a lot in the rugby lately as well. Leighton James was just a wonderful, genuine, proper, old-fashioned winger. They don't really exist anymore. To be as kind of strong as he was, wasn't wiry by any means, but just dogged. And I'm sure people have seen some of the goals. There was a famous one for Swansea and playing for Derby, and you know, just different things. But he was just great fun to watch. He could fire a shot. He was a free kick, often took off free kicks, was very, very instrumental in those teams of the kind of mid to late 70s, very slightly into the early 80s. When we got to the quarterfinals of the Euros in 76, he was an absolute key player in that series of games. And just, it's just a, just takes me back. Just takes me back and just wish his family and friends well. He was larger than life. I'm sure people might have come across him more as a pundit, perhaps in his later years. And there was, he shot from the hip, and that's how he played as well, But
that
yeah,
back and forth he had with Robbie Savage on the radio as a key example of the last thing you've said there. Obviously he was a manager. He played for a huge host of clubs: Burnley, Derby, QPR, Swansea, obviously, Sunderland, Bury, Newport County, then before finishing again at Burnley for the third time. Obviously, someone I never saw. He stopped playing for Wales in 83 and retired in 89, so it's a bit before my time. But I think it's important, that side of the 76, 78, which were great teams for us, mm-hmm. and probably should get more recognition. He scored the goal to beat England, which is the only time that Wales have ever beaten England in England, and he scored the winning goal in that game. So a hugely important figure in Welsh football. And as you say, we wish him and his family all of the best. That seems like a bit of an apt time to end, Ruth. Is there anything else you want to say there?
Did you want to touch on the FA Cup replays? I think we all know what we think about that business.
I did, just very briefly. I just think it's a damning sign of football in general that if we're scrapping the FA Cup replays, and I get what we talk about fixture congestion and whatever else, but ultimately I think there are some parts of football that should be beyond financial gain. And this whole stuff about this is about protecting players and players' welfare, and all, absolute nonsense. If managers and people want to protect players' welfare, I could fix that problem for you in 10 minutes. And it just no one would like it is that your players can only play 75% of the games that you play in a season. Done. Problem solved. But no one wants to do that because people want to pay money to go to a match and know they're going to see Kevin De Bruyne or Haaland or whoever else. Mm-hmm. And there's your problem solved right there for you. But people won't do it. So it really pisses me off that we use the premise of that we're doing this for player welfare, when in actual fact, it's without question an opportunity for the teams with the bigger squads and whatever else to get further in the competition and play fewer games. It's nonsense. And I think it's a real shame that once again, the FA and the Premier League have come together. They've held a lot of their conversations without involving a lot of the EFL clubs and stakeholders in it. They've made this decision, and then they released an entirely tone-deaf statement the day of the announcement again that basically said, oh, we did speak to all the EFL clubs. It's like, guys, this is so pathetic. It's so obvious. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a shame, I think. And, I don't know how often they have money spinning replays for smaller clubs against the bigger clubs, but just looking at Newport over the years and the things that they've enjoyed and going to Wembley Stadium to play Tottenham as an example is fantastic. And they weren't a million miles away from a replay against Man United very recently as well. So a real shame for me. And I think that one of the great things about the FA Cup, and as a Newcastle fan, thinking back to when we played Stevenage and great memories of these big clubs having to go to these tiny places, and then often these smaller clubs having to getting to go to these big stadiums in the replay is fantastic, really. So a real shame as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think it's more, from my thinking, it's more about the sort of big picture stuff of like big football and what it says, and the fact that basically the EFL have been ignored in this. There are lots of things you can do to ease the congestion for teams. Maybe those that have qualified for Europe don't come into the FA Cup till the fourth round rather than the third round. Maybe, I mean, to be honest, let's face it, a lot of the Premier League teams put out their reserves and under 23 teams anyway, I mean, I had a look. Burnley, for example, who haven't been in, admittedly haven't been involved in much all year, but they've played so far. I've played 42 games all year. You know, that's their league and what they were involved in the cup. There's no reason that they couldn't be involved in more games than they are. So yeah. I think we need to look at how we can. I would have been much happier if people had looked at how we could ease the congestion for those where there is a congestion, which are the teams that qualify for Europe. It doesn't apply to the whole of the Premier League anyway. And then, you know, they claim, oh, we're giving financial support to the lower leagues. The Premier League gives £100 million to the entirety of the EFL. That's it. Okay. So a year. Now, just as an example, just to illustrate how little that means to a top football team, in the 3 months, October, November, December, Manchester United took in £136 million just from broadcasting, just from broadcasting, no other income. Mm-hmm. So in a three-month period, they took in £136 million, and the entirety of the Premier League is giving the entirety of the EFL £100 million. That's just wrong. It should have been an integrated look at, yes, how can we help these extra demands on the teams in Europe, because we want them to be successful. But as a consequence, what do we need to do to ensure that the money from that is trickling down in a way that means we retain the ladder, we retain the pyramid, we retain football. You know, think of the excitement that Wrexham's journey is developing around football.
Yeah.
We'd be naive to think that that pyramid doesn't have value, but we're not valuing it. And I think that's my disappointment, is just another slap in the face from the big guys, basically.
I agree. And I think we're edging ever so slightly closer to some level of a full Premier League breakaway one day, whether it's Super League and some European clubs are involved as well. But, you know, they're talking about how we're going to defend people and look after players and whatever else. There's going to be more teams than ever in the Champions League this year. There's going to be more teams involved in the Euros and the World Cups coming up soon. And again, I'm not against that, as we love Welsh football, but if we're talking about defending, you know, or looking after players, sorry, and players' welfare, then those, you know, those things seem to very much fly in the face of that. Get rid of that stupid World Club Cup that no one gives a shit about. Like, again, I think it's super easy to cap a player's playing time, X amount of minutes you play a season, because then they could even play in every game, but they have to come off for the last 15 minutes or 20. Like, really, really easily manageable problems, I think. I'm sure it could all be done by computer. Some, you know, some whiz somewhere could, some boffin, as Viz always say, some boffin could go and work that out somehow. A chip in their little sports bras that they wear, whatever. Like, you know, it's not complicated as far as I'm concerned. But again, it just seems to be, you know, all the wrong decisions made for the wrong reasons, and this is very frustrating. What an irritating end to this podcast. What an annoyance. But there we are, ladies and gents. We've just got another warning from Zoom, so we better go. Shiva the dog has got a dog agility class tonight. What could possibly go wrong there?
I want photos.
God. The last time we went, he basically just, every time it wasn't his turn, he was great when it was his turn. When it wasn't his turn, he just sat there and barked the whole time. Just like, oh, another go. Oh, another go. Oh, another go. Oh, another go. Absolute menace, that boy. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for your time, Ruth.
As always.
And we'll be back. I don't know when we are going to be back soon. Hopefully soon, Ruth. But we'll be back very soon. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for your time. And we'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.